see. Rousseauists, democratism, and democracy. It is in this rationalistic or naturalistic deification of human nature that we must look for the ultimate ground of distinction between a Masonic or revolutionary republic and a Catholic republican state. According to the Rousseauist Masonic idea, a republic is only another expression for sovereignty of the people. This expression means not only that the body of the people always continues to be the governing authority in the state, but that this authority of the people is absolutely unlimited, independent of everybody, and that this absolute independence or sovereignty resides in the people as in the sum of the sovereignties of the individual citizens. Hence, amongst other consequences, it follows that the republican form of government is the only legitimate form. According to the teaching of the Catholic Church, on the contrary, the body of the people in a republic shares in the governing authority in the matter indicated in the constitution of the state. But this authority is not absolutely unlimited. It is determined by the end of the state, namely, the seeking of the common good of the people in such a way as not only not to hinder, but to favor the supernatural life and the supernatural end of citizens. It must consequently acknowledge the indirect power of the divinely appointed guides of the Catholic Church, the Pope and the bishops. The ultimate foundation, then, of the people's authority in a republic, as of authority in the other legitimate forms of government, is not the sovereign will of the people, nor the sovereign will of the individual citizen, but the authority of God. Catholics must keep well before their minds these two meanings of republic and democratic government. The whole force of Judeo-Masonic propaganda is aiming at popularizing the false Rousseauist idea of democracy. The world republic for which both Masonry and communism are working is a republic constructed on Rousseauist lines. In The Things That Are Not Caesar's, M. Maritain sums up the contrast between the two concepts as follows. Quote, political democracy as conceived by Aristotle and St. Thomas is exemplified in the old Swiss democracy and is considered by the church and philosophy as a legally possible form of government, indicated or counterindicated, in fact, according to historic conditions and circumstances. Democratism, or democracy as conceived by Rousseau, that is to say, the religious myth of democracy, is an entirely different thing from the legitimate democratic regime. Democracy, in this sense, becomes confused with the dogma of the sovereign people, that is to say, of the people as perpetual possessor and sole lawful possessor of sovereignty, which combined with the dogma of the general will and law as an expression of number, constitutes in the extreme the error of political pantheism, the multitude God. It must be borne in mind that what makes the condition of nations in modern times so tragic is that in point of fact, in concrete reality, the Rousseauist religious myth of democracy has everywhere invaded and contaminated political democracy and even every actual form of government. End of quote. On account of the importance of the question, we must here compare at some length the Catholic doctrine to authority coming from above and the Rousseauist idea of authority coming from below. Thanks to his intelligence, man grasps goodness itself. Accordingly, his will can be determined only by the good without limit. No particular finite good can force itself upon his choice. He can maintain an attitude of indifference in presence of all created things, choosing them because of their goodness or rejecting them because of their defectiveness. We are free with regard to created things, and this is a sign of our greatness, because our wills, ordained to goodness itself, can dominate their attractions. We are free with regard to God himself, and this is a sign of our weakness and misery, because the infinite good so dominates us that our intelligence can attain to it only indirectly as reflected in created things. Our acts of choice can accordingly realize concretely the true order of human ends and overthrow that order. For, like all creatures, man is obliged to tend to his own end, that is to say, to that participation of the divine perfection which is accessible and assigned to his nature. Of course, as we have just said, he tends thereto freely. He can refuse God's call and substitute for his veritable end the determination of his own caprice. It is precisely from this linking together of the notions of necessity with regard to an end and of liberty with regard to the manner of tending thereto that the notion of moral obligation arises. The whole force of obligation takes its origin in the knowledge that man has of his end. Now, if several men tend to the same end, as is the case in a society, it is indispensable that their efforts should be directed and coordinated by an intelligence lofty enough to discern and keep clearly in view, beyond and above the particular goods to which the individuals tend, the true nature of the common good of the society. This intelligence should, besides, have the power to take the steps necessary for the acquisition and preservation of this common good. Such is the significance of the authority in society. The notion of authority is essentially relative to the notion of end. If the end is not imposed and does not oblige, the authority cannot impose an obligation nor command. If the end is obligatory in virtue of a divine necessity, that is to say, as an end assigned to our nature by the creative will of God, then the authority will command in virtue of a power of the same order. It will be divine and will come from above, just as the end which it serves is divine and comes from above. This is the key to the explanation of those texts of the New Testament about the divine origin of civil authority. Our Lord replies to Pilate, who threatens to crucify him, "Thou shouldst not have any power against me unless it were given thee from above." Again, in the text of St. Paul to the Romans, "Therefore he that resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God. Wherefore be subject of necessity, not only for wrath, but also for conscience's sake. For therefore also you pay tribute." Every just law, that is, as St. Thomas explains, every law directed to the common good, not exceeding the power of the ruler who promulgates it, obliges in conscience. We can then see in what sense it will be true to say that authority should suit itself to its subjects. It ought to adapt itself, in the first place, to the end which it is its mission to procure and which, in the case of civil society, does not depend on it but on the creative will of God. In the second place, but only in the measure in which the exigencies of the end permit it, it ought to adapt itself to the subjects whom it has to direct to the end. Any concessions made by the authority can only be made with a view to the better attainment of the end. With regard to the end itself, the authority cannot compromise without destroying itself, betraying the interests of its subjects, and involving the social structure in ruin along with itself. The authority is a means between the common good and the imperfection of its subjects. It is totally and radically overthrown when it agrees to sacrifice the order of ends to the will of the multitude. What is right to the fait accompli, what is obligatory to mere caprice, the perfect to the imperfect, act to potency.